This is the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October 3rd, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to have an interesting set of runs as the IRS ends up having to try to help us get out of a problem that was created by a time they tried to help us get out of a problem, and then Congress went and changed the law. So I have some interesting runs this week. We'll have also some looks at issues about the tax status of payments to victims of the Orlando shooting. The IRS is going to update various rates for employee benefits. We're going to have the importance of following the rules in your benefit plan if you want the benefits of it. The IRS will tell us when collection agencies will begin calling taxpayers to collect tax due and how that's going to work. And an appellate court agreed with the trial court that you can't blame late filing on your attorney, no matter how badly your attorney may have failed to serve you. Well, this has been a week that I've been on the road, and I just came back from a couple of days from some days working first in Bismarck, North Dakota for 2 days last week, and then on to Boise, Idaho. I've got a few courses coming up this week in Cleveland, and then going forward after that, we're going to have a few other things happening. Cleveland this week, as I said, I have two courses there. Then we're pretty much done until after the October 15th date. However, once that's done, for those of you in Georgia, I'm going to be doing 2 days right after the 15th in Atlanta. On October the 20th, I'll be doing a course on tax research systems and methods. And October the 21st, I'm going to be doing a session on depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets. If you're in the Atlanta area, or you're going to be in the area at that point, you can go ahead and check the Georgia Society of CPAs website. You can go ahead and sign up there. Yeah, we're getting that time of year where we're going to be past our final returns due for the year, and now we're going to have to get ready for tax planning for next year. So it's a good time to catch up on your continuing education. Let's go ahead and take a look then at our first development for this week. This is a letter from the IRS Commissioner to Representative Patrick Murphy. It was issued or released by the IRS on September 23, 2016. What this ruling looked at was the tax status of payments that were being made to victims of the shootings earlier this year in Orlando, Florida. And the question that Representative Murphy asked the IRS director was, what exactly is the status if a person who is a victim of the shooting receives money from either a charity or just from individuals? Is that a taxable event for those victims? The commissioner concluded that in either case, this does not represent taxable income to the recipient. Rather, these represent non-taxable gifts. Now, obviously, that's good news for the recipient. The one caveat, though, that we should put in there is if somebody made an individual contribution, they're not going to get any charitable contribution. We've been down that road before. If you do not run this through a charitable organization, you don't give money to a charitable organization that then makes a decision as to who will benefit, we're going to end up with no deduction. The other side effect is if you gave enough, conceivably, you could have a gift tax return issue. Neither of those issues are going to be covered in this letter. But it does give letter, especially for some of those who may have been concerned that the IRS might have tried to view payments in that case to victims, relatives of victims from the Orlando shooting as a taxable event. Also probably helps when we have similar situations, hopefully not like that, but other disasters or things happen where we get these sorts of payments to victims, you know, or people who are impacted. Same basic rule should apply. Now let's go on to the next development we've got here, Revenue Ruling 2016-24. This published the SIFL Standard Industry Fare Levels, or SIFL rates, and terminal charges for the last half of 2016. These are the rates used if you have employees flying on company-provided aircraft for non-business purposes. The question is, how do we value that benefit to the employee? This rate is reset every 6 months. And now, for the period from July 1st of 2016 until December 31st of 2016, we have new rates. Generally, the flight value is the SIFL mileage rate times the number of miles plus the base terminal charge. For the last half of 2016, the terminal charge will be $37.68. The mileage rate depends on how far the plane flies. For a trip of up to 500 miles, the mileage rate is 20.61 cents per mile. For the plane goes from 501 miles to 1,500 miles, the rate is 15.72 cents per mile. And if the trip is over 1,500 miles, then the rate is 15.11 cents per mile. Again, these all begin as of July 1st of this year. They actually represent a slight decrease in the rates charged, both the terminal charge and the mileage rate. Both have a slight decrease here for the last part of the year. Also updating things for employee benefits, we have notice 2016-58. And this is where the IRS publishes, was issued on September 27th. They issue the special per diem rates. Now, as we're all aware, the basic per diem rates use the General Services Administration's tables, which you can find on the GSA's website. And as is always true, since federal government's fiscal year, begins on October 1st, every October 1st, we reset these rates. Well, those rates now, we're into October, have been reset. But also we should note that the special rates are reset. Now, there are a few special rates we're dealing with here. The first one is the special industry rate, generally for trucking and that sort of industry. That rate is set for the period from October 1st of 2016 to September 30th of 2016 at $63 for travel inside the continental United States and $68 for travel outside the continental United States. The IRS also provides that if you just want to reimburse incidentals, let's say that you have an employee, all the meals are being paid for, you know, maybe by your customer, maybe by whatever other location, whoever is paying for it, but they're not paying for incidentals. That's all the odd little things you might have to pick up and, you know, while you're on the road. That rate for this year will be $5 per day. So if for any travel anywhere, if you just want to reimburse incidentals, that's $5 per day. And finally, the high-low rates are published for this year. The high-low rates were presented. The IRS, you may recall, a couple of years ago tried to get rid of high-low rates. High-low rates are the alternative to looking up a locality in the General Services Administration table. Rather, you can just work with two rates for the year, one the general rate, and then the other for certain identified high-cost localities. The ruling here, this notice, gives us a list of the high-cost localities for the period from October 1st, 2016 to September 30, 2017. There have been additions, deletions, and modifications to the list. Some cities on that list or areas on that list are only high cost for part of the year. Some are for all of the year. If you want to use the high-low rate, what you have to do first is check where your travel went to and check it against the list of high-cost cities. If the high-cost location, if your travel is not to a high-cost location, then you go ahead and use the standard rate. If it's to a high-cost location, use the high-cost rate. The overall rate for high cost, or for I should say the general per diem, this includes hotels, you know, basically lodging, meals, incidentals, is $189 for the period from October 1st, 2016 to September 30, 2017. If it's a high cost area, that rises to $282. If you are only reimbursing meals and incidentals under this per diem program and you're using the high-low cost method, the standard rate that can be used anywhere is $57. The high-cost rate is $68. Again, remember, these rates are changing as of October 1st. So if you have reimbursements for September of last year, you know, for September, not last year, last month, those reimbursements would still be under the prior notice from last year. These are under the new notice. The rates didn't change dramatically, but it is useful to make sure you use the proper rates when you're doing these reimbursements. Next up, the IRS sometimes probably feels like they, you know, when they try to help us, that Congress then tries to ensure the help doesn't work. This is a case in Revenue Procedure 2016-49, issued on September the 27th of 2016. The IRS, in the regulations they published on the portability elections, noted that there was a little problem based on a relief revenue procedure they had issued in 2001 that probably would cause us some trouble if we wanted to elect portability. The problem we've got, now let's remember portability, how that works. You're married couple, one spouse dies, the executor of the estate, which quite often is the surviving spouse, has the right to elect to allow the surviving spouse to use any unused portion of that decedent's exclusion. So if we have a simple I love you will, where none of the exclusion for transfers at death needed to be used because there'd be no estate tax on transfers to the spouse, the entire exclusion would come over. At this point, $5 million, you know, basically $5,450,000 would be come over and could be tagged on when the second spouse dies. So getting us up near $11 million, probably after inflation adjustment for the other spouse over a few years, if they survive a few years, we'll probably be looking at a potential $11 million exclusion. Well, that's all well and good, but if you leave the property to the surviving spouse, the problem is the surviving spouse could decide to leave it to somebody other than who the first decedent thought the property would eventually be left to. That causes some concern for people who think their spouse might be misled, might, you know, in essence, fall prey to somebody who might encourage them rather than leaving the property to the kids, leave the property to their new 19-year-old friend. So in that case, we would like to transfer these this property into a trust. And we'd like to have that trust be one that is a terminable interest trust, meaning that it's, you know, income to the surviving spouse for life. But when that spouse dies, we want this property to go where we thought, the two of us thought it was going to go when the first spouse died, not where the surviving spouse may later decide, you know, that, oh, well, I think it'd be better to go here. So the problem we run into is, of course, though, you know, that sounds kind of like a credit shelter trust, which actually that is basically what a credit shelter trust would do, right? We'd leave it income for life, and it's excluded from the surviving spouse's estate. Well, for years, we've had the ability to do that in taxable estates. After we filled up the credit shelter trust, we could still leave other assets in trust to the spouse and then make what was called a qualified terminable interest election. That is a Q-tip election. Now, this, when we do a qualified terminable interest property election under Section 2056B7, the surviving spouse agrees that even though this shouldn't be in that person's estate, that they will agree that it will be treated in their estate, even though they don't have control over where the assets go. And then that allows us to treat that as passing to the spouse. That allows us to get the full exclusion, which is what we used to be worried about here. So we didn't have to tax, we didn't have to pay tax on the transfer to the spouse. And the other side effect of that, though, of course, is included in the surviving spouse's estate, which means that it will get a step up in basis. Now, with portability, we may, you know, we're not going to have a taxable estate of $11 million. We would like to be able, though, to, let's say, instead of, you know, burning up, we would like to be able to get a second step up on the assets. So instead of passing it into a credit shelter trust to ensure that it doesn't go where we don't want it to go, we go ahead and let it go through portability so that when the surviving spouse dies 4 or 5 years later, we get a second step up. But the problem is we had an old ruling that Revenue Procedure 2001-38 provided that if you try to make a Q-tip election and that Q-tip election was not necessary to reduce the estate tax below zero, the IRS figured that you made a mistake. So that ruling said any such election that was not, to the extent it was not necessary to reduce the tax to zero, we would go ahead and treat that as an inadvertent election and void. Well, unfortunately, now we'd like to make that election, even though it will not affect the estate tax at all. We're making the election to get a step up in basis at the second death. The IRS in the regulations for portabilities recognized this problem and said that they expected to issue some guidance later on to try to work with this. Now, in Revenue Procedure 2016-49, issued on September 27th, we have this relief. What we're going to change in that old ruling now is, if you make a portability election on a Form 706, then you will not be able to void a Q-tip election. In essence, if you make the Q-tip election and there's a portability checkbox there, that's considered to be a valid Q-tip election and there's no option to get rid of it. Even if you don't make the portability election, we're still not going to assume the Q-tip election is invalid. What would have to happen at that point, if you notice the problem, is this provides a mechanism where if you did not make the Q-tip election and you effectively, you know, say, look, to the extent we didn't need it to reduce the tax, that was a mistake. And you file basically a revised 706 and you, you know, say that you're coming under this rule, then we will void that Q-tip election. So there will no longer be automatically voided Q-tip elections under this rule. There'll be the possibility of voiding them, but if you check the box to make a portability election, you will not be able to go back later and say, oh, I want to void it. Why might you do that? Obviously, there are various reasons why you might decide at the end, oh, no, I didn't mean to do that. You know, I don't want to treat that as a Q-tip election. I want to now treat it as a credit shelter trust because it turns out that we invested in the next Apple stock and a next Apple from the 90s, whatever that is, that becomes super, super valuable over the next 5 years. And so we don't want, you know, we'd prefer to keep it out. No, we're not going to let you second guess that way. Portability election and Q-tip is always going to be a valid Q-tip election. But we are going to allow, if you did make portability and you tell us now, oh, I fouled up, I really should have, you know, not checked the box to say I'm going to make a Q-tip election, then the IRS will still allow you to get out. But now you have to contact the service to have that happen instead of having that happen automatically. Our next ruling is a Chief Counsel email 2016-39015 issued on September the 23rd. This is a problem where the employers in this case failed to follow the stated rules of their employee benefit program. And because of that, they lost the benefit of that program, which in this case was escaping FICA taxation. The issue was a plan to pay supplemental unemployment benefits. In this particular case, it was a multiple employer plan, and it was set up where if an employee didn't work enough hours during the month, there'd be payments made out of the supplemental trust that would, you know, basically give the employee some additional money. The theory being that that would allow the employee, you know, to deal with the fact they're not getting paid as much because there wasn't as much work to be done. The plan said that they would only pay out to employees who qualified for state unemployment benefits under, you know, a reduced work program of the state. Now, if that was true, as the IRS points out, there is an old revenue ruling that would allow you to go back, in essence, in the regulations, or essentially regulations and revenue ruling 56249 and revenue ruling 90-72, that would provide that those payments are not subject to FICA taxation, which is good news for the employer. However, in this case, all the employers did was reported and had paid out of the trust any employee that worked less than X hours. While the trust said they were supposed to verify they qualified for state unemployment, the employers did not do so. The email concludes that that failure to follow that rule meant that this was not a qualified trust. And because it was not a qualified trust, all the payments made out of this trust were FICA taxable. The key takeaway from this is if Congress gives us a benefit or the IRS, you know, in the regs has some sort of benefit for a program, it's not enough just to sign the piece of paper. It's not enough to say, well, they probably would have qualified anyway. You have to follow the program exactly to get the benefit in question. In this case, the employers were not following the program exactly. So in this case, the employers ended up having to pay FICA taxes that they otherwise probably would have escaped had they actually verified that these employees were qualifying for state unemployment benefits. Next up, we have an IRS news release that came out on September the 26th of this week. This is news release IR 2016-125. This news release deals with the IRS's beginning to use private collection agencies to collect overdue taxes. The Congress mandated that the IRS use private collection agencies in the Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act of 2015. In theory, the IRS was supposed to start doing this by last March. In reality, the program simply didn't get started. Now the IRS will tell us that they're going to start the program. What they announced in this, first they announced the four agencies. So that's one key thing to note, is these are the four agencies that will legitimately be able to call taxpayers. That includes the CBE Group of Cedar Falls, Iowa, the Conserve of Fairport, Kentucky, Performant of Livermore, California, and Pioneer of Horseheads, New York. One key concern a lot of people have had has been that given the amount of fraud, phone fraud that's taken place with people claiming to be from the IRS, is this throw out to private collection agencies going to just start a whole new round of fraud with now callers claiming to be private collection agencies that are calling on behalf of the IRS? Frankly, I would suspect that as soon as these programs roll out, that's what we'll see. The IRS tells us they're going to start these programs in the spring of next year. They didn't give us a date next spring that they're going to start, so we'll just have to keep our eyes open for when they actually get the program rolling. But they did tell us a couple of details that'll be important. First, if a taxpayer's account is turned over to one of these four agencies, the IRS will write a letter to the taxpayer informing them of that fact. As well, before the agency can contact the taxpayer by phone, the agency will have to also send out a letter to the taxpayer stating that they're working on behalf of the IRS and they're trying to collect an old overdue tax debt. So that's our background that we look at for this. The key is going to be communicating this to clients. I suspect, and it's not just the clients that have collection problems. In fact, I suspect those clients, like it or not, they've been dodging the service forever. They are highly unlikely to actually pay the collection agency either. I don't care what you threaten some of these people who are, you know, who are way behind. The reason why they're way behind is because they're very good at saying, you know, at not paying is part of the time. Sometimes it's okay, but we all know there's that group. That group probably won't be victimized. But who could be victimized are some of your clients who don't normally deal with collections in the IRS. You probably want to let them know about this rule, that the IRS is going to start using private collection agencies. But if somebody calls you, claim to be a private collection agency, number one, you should not get any such call until the IRS sends you a letter and that collection agency has sent you a letter. If you get this call out of the blue, it's a fraudster. You know, make sure your clients understand. In fact, as we've talked all through the past few months, the IRS is moving more and more to require contact by mail before any contact by phone. This just extends that one more point. But certainly warn your clients, and I'd warn them early next tax season, because I expect as soon as this program rolls out, there'll be press coverage that collection agencies are calling taxpayers, and then the fraudsters will be on the phone in about 2 minutes afterwards. Finally, we have a final development this week. We have the case of Speck versus United States. This is a case from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's an affirmation of a case from the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Ohio that we discussed earlier. What this case comes down to is the attorney in question was hired by the individual who was appointed to be executor of the estate to help advise her on the estate. She had never been an executor before. She actually had never been in an attorney's office before she took over this estate. Now, this estate was fairly large, and you know, it was a taxable estate, and there had a lot of UPS stock was what part of it was. Now, unbeknownst to the executor, the attorney had recently been diagnosed with brain cancer, and her practice began to suffer. You know, her performance began to seriously suffer as part of this. The executor got notices about various missed deadlines from the state of Ohio and from other organizations. But when she got them, she'd contact the attorney who constantly assured her that everything was fine. Well, it turns out everything wasn't fine. The attorney also failed to get the estate tax return filed, although, again, she assured the executor that all was well. Eventually, the executor, after being contacted by other individuals, who she knew that had worked with this attorney, who said, you know, there's something really wrong now with this attorney. You really should get somebody else. Finally fired this attorney, brought on a new one who their friends had suggested she should bring on. And the new attorney, of course, found out that nothing had been filed. So the new attorney went through, got everything taken care of. They filed the estate tax return. But now the IRS charged the estate with a failure to file penalty. The estate asked for relief due to reasonable cause. The Sixth Circuit, agreeing with the district court in Ohio, held that a failure to file cannot be excused by the actions of an agent. There'd be a subtle difference had the attorney advised her that no estate tax return was due. In that case, that's just bad legal advice, and she's allowed to, as long as it's reasonable, to rely on the advice, the legal advice. But she couldn't just assume the attorney would file the necessary documents. And in fact, as the court pointed out, she had evidence from earlier that there might be problems anyway. But even if she didn't, the basic rules the court note is ensuring that timely filing takes place is a taxpayer's responsibility. And the taxpayer will not get reasonable cause by saying, I thought the attorney or I thought the accountant took care of it. The bad side of that for us as the attorney or accountant is that the state court, when they do a malpractice suit, is not necessarily going to take the same position. In fact, probably almost certainly won't. And in fact, in this case, there was a settlement with the attorney about a malpractice payment. So you need to be very careful there, as I said, about due dates, and be very careful about these. Failure to file, you know, if the CPA, and you know, what's real interesting here too is, had the attorney been the executor, her disease, you know, her basically, her illness, her inability to do it, her reduced mental function apparently, that was part of this disease, that all would have probably excused the estate from late filing. But the fact that she was the attorney, we're not concerned about reasonable cause for what she did. We're concerned about reasonable cause for what the executor did, which was failing to ensure that the return got filed. Well, it's coming up on, as we know, the October 15th or this year 17th drop dead due date. But immediately following that, we've got to get ready for all of our tax planning. Planning season's just around the corner. And while you're taking a little bit breather here just before the final week push, you might go ahead and take a look at some of the courses your state society has offered between that October 15th date and that time sometime in December when you decide you're done for the year with doing courses. State societies have lots of offerings in many areas during this two-month period. So be sure, go ahead, go to your local state society website and check to see the courses that are coming up and get your continuing education taken care of for this year and be ready to serve your clients during those tax planning meetings you're going to be having here shortly. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October 3rd, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments, again, is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE. You can get our daily updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I guess they're not quite daily, but we post quite often. So you can read things as they develop during the week. I'll post items there. If you have any questions, you can send them to us, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. Well, as I said, I'm going to spend this week heading off to Cleveland. So if any of you are going to be there, I look forward to seeing you there. After that, I get to finish up all the stuff before October 17th. So I've got a little bit over a week to clean up the final few things I've got to clean up that are still pending to be taken care of. And so, and I hope you all have a good October 17th date. And hope, look forward, though, next week as you're getting ready for that final push week. We'll go over the updates in that week, and we'll talk to you all through the rest of this year on the issues coming up on Current Federal Tax Developments.